Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 340, I chat with Peter Otto, Chief Scientific Officer at Comhear, about his work on beamforming technology. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWiT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded February 9th, 2017, episode 340, Binaural Beamforming. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Peter Otto, Chief Scientific Officer of Comhear, a company working on implementing something called beamforming technology. Hey, Peter, welcome to the show.
How's it going?
Good, thanks. Thanks so much for being here.
Nice to see you.
Those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv can go to the chat room, or you can go to irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps if you put my screen name, which is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or spaces, in the message somewhere, and that makes it show up in a different color on my screen, and I'll be able to see it more easily. Also, I want to tell all of our TWiT fans that we want to hear from you in our new audience survey. It should only take you a couple minutes to fill out, and it will give us a general idea of who our audience is and what you'd like to see, and also it helps us select advertisers that we think you would be most interested in. And of course, many of you take privacy very seriously. We do too, and we want to make sure that you know we promise to always protect that. We don't identify you in any way in the survey. It's all totally anonymous. So head on over to twit.tv/survey now. Well, after the show. And we thank you very much for your input. So, Peter, I'd like to start with a little bit of an explanation of what beamforming is. We're going to get more into it as we go. But I think as a starting point, we're going to talk a little physics here.
Okay. Yeah. So beamforming is a very interesting phenomenon in acoustics. You find it also in other scientific pursuits. For example, a lot of beamforming theory was developed around radar in the 30s and 40s. But in acoustics specifically, beamforming refers to the ability to delay and sum waveforms such that we control the shape of a wave in 3D audio space. In other words, in acoustical space. So the classic example of that is if you think for a moment about a sine wave. You know, of course, a sine wave is an S-shaped wave on its side, which
the simplest possible waveform, really.
That's right. That's right. Yes. Contains no harmonics and emits a very pure tone. So if I add two sine waves together, I get, as you might expect, an increase in the amplitude or the volume of those two sounds as they mix acoustically. However, if I delay one so that it's exactly 180 degrees out of phase, so essentially I have a positive going wave as well as a negative going wave that combine in space together, what do you think I'm going to get there?
Well, I would say nothing.
You would get nothing. So, in fact, the first example that I explained there is an example of additive acoustical summing or constructive waveforms. And the second would be destructive waveforms or destructive phase relationships. So two out-of-phase signals can cancel each other. So,
which is in fact how active noise canceling headphones work.
That's right. That's right.
Although it's on more complicated waves than sine waves.
Yes. Yes, it is. Although you'll notice that active noise canceling headphones tend to be more effective in low frequencies than high frequencies.
Also in steady state rather than in time varying sound.
That's right. Yeah. So at any rate, we can control wave shapes. We can control amplitude by controlling the phase and time domain and addition of two waveforms in space. And it turns out that that there's a lot that you can do with it. One example, as you mentioned, is controlling noise. So there's something in acoustic theory called anti-noise. And if I add noise plus anti-noise, and I'm very careful about the phase alignment of those two signals, then, in fact, I can cancel noise. And that's exactly what's happening in our noise-canceling headphones, which companies like Bose and others have introduced and are extremely useful.
I would never go on a plane without mine, that's for sure.
Me either, especially the long hauls. I mean, yeah. Right. Yeah, so in fact, I'm wearing the Bose right now. There's a fair amount of HVAC noise in my office here at UCSD, and I'm hearing none of it. It's quite quiet within my little cocoon. Mm-hmm. What's happening here is I've got a little microphone on each headphone. It's listening to the environment, and it is producing an out-of-phase a copy of the signal that's going into the headphone. It's mixing that with the acoustic sound that is leaking into my headphone from the environment and from the slight leakages around the earpieces. Those are adding together and radically lowering the noise that's reaching my ear canals by mm-hmm. probably 30 dB or so.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So turns out there's some interesting things that you can do besides noise cancellation and radar. One of them has been exploited for many years in audio PA systems. So think about the PA systems that you've seen in a big live concert. You'll notice often that the speakers are trapezoidally shaped, and they're put into a series in which there's a careful angular relationship. And that generally is a kind of arcing relationship that swings down from ceiling to the middle of the auditorium and progressively swings away from the audience. And what you're getting there is some beamforming, so you get very solid coverage in the area that needs coverage, and you're also eliminating a fair amount of leakage on side beams. That's an example of a simple kind of mechanical beamforming that that is used in PA PA.
Isn't that interesting? I hadn't realized that. I've seen those big PA systems with the line array essentially of speakers
mm-hmm. yes.
that curve yes. away from the audience, but I had no idea that was a rudimentary form of actual beamforming.
Yes.
Pretty cool.
As audio technology and in live sound becomes more and more complex and benefits more and more from signal processing, you'll find that there are smart sound servers and signal processors behind those systems that allow the engineers to tune the system so that you get excellent coverage, you get equalization where there might be dips or peaks in equalization. But in fact, there is some increasingly sophisticated active beamforming that takes place.
Which is what we're going to talk about today. Before we do, though, yes. I want to give everybody sort of a sense, a visual sense. If you're watching the video, you'll be able to see something kind of cool here. The first graphic that we have is a very simple interference pattern caused by two point sources of sound radiating out in all directions. This is very similar to what you would get if you tossed two rocks into a pond. Right. Tell us what we're looking at here.
Yeah, so this is probably a MATLAB rendering of a sound field. There's a new area of acoustics called sound field modeling. And what we're doing is we're basically number crunching additive and cancellation waves such that the darker red areas of this graphic indicate an amplitude peak, and the darker blue areas indicate a amplitude cancellation. So where there's red, there's going to be a lot of sound. Where there's blue, there's not going to be much sound. Where there's yellow, there's something in between. And then you'll notice the two red dots right in the middle. Essentially, those are speakers. And what I imagine is taking place here is we've got, let's say, a couple of 500 hertz sine tones that are in some way phase offset from one another. And from a certain point of view, we can see that there are very strong peaks and very radical dips. And literally, if you walked through that sound field, you would hear areas where there's almost no sound at all and areas where the 500 hertz sine wave is very, very loud. It's kind of magical. It's a wonderful thing. The analogy that you made of tossing a couple of pebbles into a still pond is a good one, too, because, of course, those ripples, when they combine with each other, create new sorts of patterns, and some of them are canceling and some of them are reinforcing.
Mm-hmm. Now, if these two speakers, if the red dots are speakers, let's say, you change the, and they're both emitting 500 hertz sine waves.
Yes.
And you change the phase of one with relation to the other, or delayed it slightly, which is the same thing.
Yes.
Then the shape of this pattern would shift. It would move around a little bit, right?
Absolutely correct. You must have been an excellent physics student.
Well, I did get my undergraduate degree in physics, so.
Oh, well, okay. Very good. Yeah.
There you go.
So, right, yeah. And so, in fact, also, even if I moved one of those speakers relative to the other, we'd see some disturbances in that pattern or change of shape in those patterns. Mm-hmm. Of course, the cause of which would be the speed of sound and the delay caused by the speed of sound as those two wave fronts meet. So turns out that in the new world of audio, which can be mitigated by rapid signal processing, we can dynamically control the phase relationships of these two speakers. And it turns out that if we put several speakers together in a row to form what's called a line array, we can do something even fancier than just peaks and troughs. We can construct a sound field that has very strong reinforcement where we want strong reinforcement and very strong rejection in the areas where we're designing the cancellation frequencies. And I believe
and we have a diagram to show that as well. Yeah.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Yeah. So if we pull up number two, we should be able to see that.
Yep.
There we go.
Very good. Yeah. So you can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It looks like 10 or 12 speakers in a row. And this is actually a picture of a sound field model from our lab, and it's showing the rejection and reinforcement pattern. So, in fact, we've told our DSP to please form a beam very strongly, exactly in the center, and then form another beam at around 45 degrees. And then you can see that, in fact, there's going to be about a let's see, I think blue is going to be around 40 or 50 dB down from solid red. So you can see that there's quite a radical differentiation between the center of the beam and the cancellation areas, especially the most dark blue cancellation areas. So literally, if the scale that we're working here, that we're looking at is, let's say, a 1 foot wide 12-inch array, and we are viewing this array and listening to the array from, say, 3 feet in front of the array. If I'm dead center, I'm going to hear a very, very loud signal. If I take two steps to my left, I'm going to hear a null spot. So the signal will be pretty faint.
Much. Yeah,
not going to hear very much. Now, it's interesting. We can also see that to the left, there is I'd have to say is an unintentional lobe. So, and isn't it interesting? It appears to be at exactly the same angle as our second beamform off to the right.
Just on the right, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was wondering about that. So this looks kind of symmetrical.
Yeah. So it turns out. So let's say that if I'm dead center to the array. So if I'm looking at the center array, I'm at 0 degrees. Mm-hmm. If I'm off to the right in the center of the right beam, I would be at about plus 45 degrees relative to 0. Mm-hmm. And if I go off to the left, I would be at negative 45. So you can see that at negative 45, there seems to be an artifact. And that artifact, in fact, is caused by our front 45 degree beam. And this is predictable, and this is a function of a simple delay in some beamforming. So it's interesting, but in fact, that negative 45 is not desirable for some of the applications that we have in mind for high-quality audio. A fair amount of my work and my work with my colleagues, both at UCSD and at University of Southampton, has to do with optimizing the performance of beamformers in applications that have to do with very high quality audio. Mm-hmm. So if I use a signal processor to produce the constructive and deconstructive characteristics of my beamforming, I can also add optimization to my signal processing routine such that it will cancel or it will remove some of these artifacts without compromising the acoustic or the spectral or the beamforming quality of the intended signal. So we're going from basic theory into some application explanations pretty quickly here. But you can see that if I have that kind of control, there are very fancy things that we can do with sound. And I would say that this is this type of work is emblematic of a next generation of audio and signal processing and new types of experiences that are going to be available to consumers at fairly reasonable prices and accessible in the marketplace in the weeks and months ahead.
Mm-hmm. iPhone 87656, otherwise known as Hamid, is wondering about how he has problems with soundbars and mm-hmm. wonders if something like this. The problem is that the soundbars he's tried so far don't really replicate 5.1 or 7.1 sound very well. And I'm just mentioning this to say that that's the topic of today's show. So you're going to get a lot about that.
That's a very astute question, and we'll definitely get into that during this hour.
Exactly. Crack Monster in the chat room is asking, is this a picture showing a single speaker as the source, or are you talking about an array? We're talking about an array here, what's called a line array. So a bunch of speakers in a line, right?
Yep, yep. Yeah, so let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It looks like 10 speakers. And those, in this particular example, those speakers are about 1 inch in diameter. So something that has not been done before, and that was really pretty original to the work that my lab at UCSD engaged in, is to apply some of this beamforming theory to a very small form factor so that we could deliver some new kinds of high fidelity and auditory imaging experiences to small groups of listeners or even personal listeners. So what had been applied on in the previously mentioned example of an auditorium or even a sports arena, which is an environment where you really need a lot of directional control, because sports arenas tend to be very, very reflective and have a hard time with intelligibility. In a space like that, you really need to a lot of control. So we, around 8 or 9 years ago, I started doing some research in a small form factor beamforming, and it turned out that there had been very little investigation of this. At the same time, due to small desktop computer systems and gaming systems and all kinds of portable media like laptop computers and cell phones and portable Bluetooth speakers and, you know, any number of small portable devices that that produce audio, a new generation of less expensive, lightweight, and better sounding full range small speakers became available. Around the same time, a new generation or new generations of signal processing chips became available. For example, the famous Motorola 56000 set, the Shark chips.
Shark was analog devices, but that's another example.
Right, right. Yeah, that's just a different brand of a signal processing chip, which is widely used in audio. Wilson, also acquired by Cirrus recently, has a beautiful set of signal processing chips that, by the way, handle a lot of I/O. So 16 channels of input, 16 channels of output, which right off the shelf is applicable to the kinds of applications that that we had in mind.
Amazing. You mentioned earlier, a moment ago, that you work at UCSD, University of California, San Diego, and also at the University of Southampton, did you say?
We have colleagues at Southampton. Southampton. And we also we have some students who did their undergraduate work here and have gone on to PhD program at Southampton. There's been a fair amount of back and forth. Most of that stemming from a research relationship that Dr. Filippo Fazzi and myself have maintained over the years. And ISVR, the Institute of Sound and Vibration Research, is a great lab out of the University of Southampton. And at University of California, San Diego, we have very strong programs in computer music, as well as electrical engineering, wireless theory, and so forth. And we also have the California Institute of Information Technology and Information and Telecommunications Technologies, sometimes called the Qualcomm Institute, where I established a lab about 8 or 9 years ago and where a lot of this work took place.
Well, this reminds me then, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this reminds me that, or indicates to me that, really, it's somewhat cross-disciplinary. What we're talking about today has sort of come about from the interaction of a variety of different disciplines in academia, as you are. But also elsewhere. We have a graphic actually to show that, number three. I think it's number three. And you can tell us here how all of these different studies interact to end up with where you are.
Yeah, great. So, Yeah, this tells an interesting story. I'm glad you were able to put this graphic up because it, I think, is indicative of a wider trend in innovation and technology development, which is that a lot of innovation now takes place across disciplines. Many disciplines in their sort of rigidly defined areas of expertise, of course, continue to produce basic science that is relevant to subfields that that are related to the kind of core field. On the other hand, a lot of leading research universities have realized that there is this cross-pollination of disciplines that can lead to rapid innovation, and it's very often due to a combination of several disciplines working together on new kinds of problems. So, in fact, this work in advanced acoustics technologies, in other words, microphone arrays and speaker arrays, really lies at the intersection of the field of acoustics and physics. Computer science obviously has a lot to do with it, with the signal processing interface design and so forth. Music and entertainment technology, audio engineering, of course, is pretty central. Audio engineering for communications is a big application area, and a lot of the work that we did leverages speech and hearing science, as well as communication science. VR and AR for advanced visualization enters in here. Electrical engineering and DSP, of course. And then, interestingly, cognitive science and brain science.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
So, you know, in the end, you know, those of us who are working in audio and video are essentially in the field of perception science or perception applications. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about virtual reality or augmented reality and 3D visualization, 3D auralization, essentially we're talking about manipulating perception so that we can derive immersive experience from traditional means of rendering visual and auditory experience.
Well, certainly immersive audio and immersive video in terms of VR are sort of really big topics these days. So I think you're riding the crest there, my friend.
Thank you. One other little point that I would make is that leading research universities also have taken interesting steps in leveraging these more rapid innovation strategies for which combine multiple disciplines together, and in an institute like the Qualcomm Institute are partnering more and more closely through incubators and through sponsored research and through licensing programs and partnerships with startups and technology companies, some of them very large, some of them embryonic. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, is the case with Comm here, which is a direct outgrowth of the Qualcomm Institute here. Comm here was incubated by the Qualcomm Institute at UCSD, and as things developed, began to build the confidence that there was something valuable here, there was something innovative here that had a lot of interesting real-world applications, and so started funding research and working towards the goal of developing the research to the point that we could start pulling products out of it and fine-tuning applications for a number of fields of use.
Mm-hmm. SSB201 in the chat room is asking, does the array need to be arranged with multiple speakers in both vertical and horizontal layouts in order to beamform in three dimensions? We're going to probably get a little bit more into that a little later, but I thought I would just bring it up now to get your initial thoughts on it.
Okay. I could comment really quickly on that. So That's a great question. And if we want excellent beamforming in both the vertical and horizontal dimension, then we need both vertical and horizontal line arrays. In other words, let's say instead of a 10 by 1 array, we might want to use a 10 by 4 array to give us a better vertical additive and subtractive capabilities. That said, however, we can do excellent 3D auditory imaging. That is, we can render such that you will hear vertical auditory images from a simple 2D line array. And we can do that by using binaural encoding. And I think I don't want to jump down that rabbit hole quite yet.
Actually, binaural encoding and binaural playback or reproduction is our next port of call. But okay. if you will allow me for just a moment to take this moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Grasshopper. Now, Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but it requires no hardware purchase. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. And when you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing and make your business sound more professional. You can set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. And you can get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. So join over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month, and you have a 30-day money-back guarantee. So turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. And we thank Grasshopper very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. So we were just about to start talking about binaural reproduction, which... By the name of what we're going to talk about, binaural, two oral, we have two ears, right? So we hear the world in a binaural fashion naturally. But when we try to reproduce on a stereo system, on a two-channel system, we run into some problems, don't we?
Yes. Yep. So, so binaural is not the same as stereo. Stereo is the phenomena of presenting, recording using two microphones or at least two channels of storage, audio that is then rendered on two separate speakers. And what stereo does well is it gives you a nice blend of the auditory scene such that it sounds pretty good within reason at about 180 degree arc around the speakers. So it averages very well. But
we have a picture of that actually. The next one called Sound Field, and we should be able to see that. There it is.
Right. Okay. So the pink part of that display shows the area where we get good stereo coverage, and so if we're seated within, let's say, if this is indicating, I can't quite see the scale, but if this is indicating a 10 by 15 soundstage, then we have a fairly large and wide soundstage that will deliver pretty reasonably imaged stereo audition. However, in the kind of purple zones, once we are inside of those purple zones, we will primarily hear the closest speaker. okay, so if I'm off on the right, then I'm going to mostly hear the right side speaker. And if there's not much stereo information in the right side speaker or center channel information in the right side speaker, then I'm not going to hear that very well. And the auditory image will become lopsided and therefore a little bit distorted. So we'll start to lose the kind of nicely blended stereo image and our stereo perspective is compromised. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what can we do about that? One thing we can do is we can just always stay in that area. But it turns out that if we listen to headphones, we get quite a different image. And one of the things that we get is a pretty good soundstage with some exceptions. On the other hand, headphones present their own problems. They actually introduce a different timbral artifact than what we hear with speakers. And our friend David Griesinger has written extensively on this and has done some amazing demonstrations of how different music sounds in the ear canal when it's presented by a speaker or when it's presented by headphones. And there's also another imaging problem that you get with headphones, which is if you think really carefully and honestly to yourself, what happens when a stereo signal goes from left to right and you're auditioning on headphones?
It goes right through the middle of your head.
Yes, I hear, and most people perceive that sound does not externalize. When a sound is panned from left to right, it goes through the middle of your head. And that's a problem. That is not an accurate representation of what music sounds like in the real world. If you can contrast that to what instruments sound like in a jazz club or in a fine-sounding chamber hall, say in an opera when a singer is moving across the stage, we don't perceive that as going through our head. We perceive that as being a multidimensional image. It has depth, it has width, it has height. And
it's out there in front of you.
right. Yeah, it's not walking through, the singer is not walking through my head. That localization has a context, and that context can be very, very vivid. Now, it turns out that just a pair of stereo microphones, if they're properly deployed, can capture a lot of stereo imagery. The problem is that very often that stereo imagery is not very well rendered. And what we get with stereo speakers is a nice averaging. And with great stereo speakers, if we sit just in the right place and everything is tuned and we've got a nicely tuned room and we've got acoustic control and so forth, then we can get a fair amount of dimensionality from a pair of stereo speakers. But for the most part, stereophony collapses into a nicely averaged sound field that doesn't reveal much dimensionality. And then we mentioned the problem with headphones, and the problem with headphones is, yes, we get a lot of clarity, we get a fair amount of definition, but the image is collapsed inside of our head, and it doesn't externalize very well. Right. So it turns out that there are some techniques for mitigating that problem. I should mention that the reason that the problem exists with regular stereo is due to something called crosstalk.
And, right, and we have a diagram to show that, to illustrate
yeah,
that.
Yeah, okay, perfect, yeah. Okay, so yeah, what this diagram is showing us that is that direct sound from speakers reaches your ears as you would expect. So the solid red and green lines, red is right, green is left, are reaching the ears that they're intended to reach. But due to crosstalk, some of the sound from the left speaker hits the right ear and vice versa. So the broken green line is leaking over to the right ear, and the broken red line shows that audio from the right speaker is leaking over to the left ear. And this creates a blur in the spatial image, and the dimension, the dimensionality of the stereo source, or even a carefully recorded binaural source is compromised. We'll talk about what binaural recording is in a little bit.
Yeah.
But at any rate, so you get the idea. Crosstalk is kind of what the name implies. Some of the right channel leaks into our left ear. Some of the left channel leaks into our right ear, and that causes a blur in accuracy and soundstage. That is,
which doesn't of course occur with headphones because the two ears are isolated. But
right.
We have other problems with headphones.
We have other problems because you know if the left speaker is a cello and the right speaker is a violin. Yes, we get crosstalk, but we also get a lot of the direct signal. And in fact, that balances well, whereas if we record that with a stereo microphone, we don't get so much crosstalk. And in that case, both with regular speakers as well as with headphones, we're not reproducing the right amount of crosstalk. In one case, there's too much. In the other case, there's not enough. There's a process called crosstalk cancellation, and crosstalk cancellation can eliminate the leakage between the right channel and the left channel. As I said earlier, though, we don't want to completely eliminate that because that if you completely eliminate crosstalk, then you get what you get with headphones, which is you lack lateralization, and sounds that are moving from left to right or right to left sound like they're going through your head. So
it's true. So, for example, a singer on the stage in an opera, as you pointed out before, they're singing over on the right side of the stage, but that sound is going to still reach your right ear, but also somewhat a little bit your left ear, even in a live situation. So you do want some crosstalk.
Yes. Yeah. And plus there's also reflections that get into both ears, and there's a very delicate balance of direct sound versus reflected sound, as well as crosstalk sound, which is in a natural acoustical environment. The far ear does allow some leakage to get in. So what we really want to do is we want to be able to produce that that dimensionality and that mixture of direct sound and indirect sound very well. And that takes us back to beamforming. So it turns out that if you use beamforming to optimize right channel audio information and to beam it onto the right ear, controlling the amount of crosstalk that goes onto the left ear. And I'm not saying cancellation, I'm saying control. So in fact, we've come up with this this idea, crosstalk control, as a very important component to getting stereophony right. So if I control the amount of crosstalk that's getting into your left ear, and I beamform my left signal so that most of the audio from my left signal is going onto your left ear, but a little bit of it is getting onto your right ear, then, in fact, this eliminates that ambiguity, the blur, and the lack of dimensionality that is caused by crosstalk. And so it turns out that using beamforming, going back 10 minutes to our earlier conversation, in a linear array and simply using nicely recorded stereo music and then literally pointing left channel information onto your left ear as though we have a flashlight beaming sound onto your left ear and then pointing the right channel information onto your right ear. Let's use the analogy of a regular speaker is like a floodlight. A beamforming speaker is like a spotlight. So we're able to direct left channel information on your left ear, right channel information onto your right ear. We control the amount of leakage that goes back and forth, and voila, what happens is you get 3D audio. That is a breakthrough, and that is something that's not been done in a commercial product before.
Mm-hmm. And we have a graphic to sort of illustrate that a little bit.
Yeah.
The next one in the series, let's take a look at that one. Okay, so here we have a line array, a beamforming line array, presumably, and most of the sound is, in fact, only getting to the ear it's intended for.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, this graphic is not particularly an oversimplification. There's a few details that we leave out. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but it really conveys the primary notion here, which is we are using this line array to focus one channel of audio on the correct ear and another channel of audio on the other correct ear. And in fact, actually for the right channel information, every single one of the speakers is being used. Some of them are used for reinforcement, or the primary component is used for reinforcement. Some of them are using to cancel the amount of audio getting to the unintended ear. But in the end, what you get is the sense that you're locked into an acoustical beam that balances very, very well. And when you get inside of that beam, the sound goes from kind of a flat-sounding stereo. It sounds very good. It sounds like regular stereo. But once you're in the balanced beam, what you get is a lot of detail, and every instrument seems to have its correct place. And the overall sound field is much, much wider even than the apparent width of the beamformer. So the beamformer might be 20 inches wide, but what you hear is a soundstage that is 20 feet wide. So this is a kind of breakthrough. It's perhaps even a disruptive technology. And we see a couple of very, very high-end companies that are starting to explore this technology for consumer high-end speakers. ComHear has been working on this probably for longer than anyone else, and is doing a lot of exploration in terms of audiophile quality, but at much more affordable price points than the high-end companies are working on.
Well, speaking of which, we've got a couple of questions from the chat room on that subject. Tinker Toy Tech asks, isn't this what Polk Audio did with the cable between the pair of speakers? And how about Carver Sonic Hologram?
Carver Sonic Hologram was definitely a step in this direction. And, hats off. Carver became very concerned and interested and a strong proponent of sonic imagery. And there have been I can't say that I know exactly what techniques they were using, but there was some attempt at crosstalk cancellation, but it was using a standard stereo. And there is an inherent problem in crosstalk cancellation, which is unintended artifacts which pop up. A key to the work that we're doing and that we've done with Professor Fozzi has to do with the optimization and minimization of unintended artifacts, both timbrally and in terms of lobing that can distort the image or put sound in the wrong place. So the idea of controlling crosstalk is by no means an entirely new idea. The application of a very high level of real-time signal processing, the application of new materials. I should also say the availability of very small, high efficient, and low distortion Class D amplifiers also is an important component to this work. These are new techniques being applied to an old idea, which in theory we've understood for quite some time, which is that crosstalk tends to deteriorate auditory imaging, and if we can control crosstalk, we can get an improvement in auditory imaging. What's new is the techniques, several advanced techniques, including the new science of sound field modeling, which essentially builds a mathematical model between, in the acoustical space that's defined by your ears and the speaker array, and basically building beamforming that is targeting specifically your ears, given the spacing and the geometry and the characteristics of the individual drivers. Mm-hmm. There have been attempts at this type of technology in the past, mostly using an active crosstalk cancellation. I know of some brilliant work that's been done in university laboratories that in fact uses stereo speakers with good results, but they tend to not be very practical for real world use, either due to expense or amount of computing power needed, or things like customized measurements on the head and torso and ears, that sort of thing.
SoundPro 69 is asking about ambiophonic. Ralph Glaskell?
So there are a lot of, I should say, in general, the world of 3D audio has really experienced a big uptick in the last several years, mostly due to the excitement and investment that's been put into VR and AR types of technologies. But also, I think also due to the advancement of scientific analytical tools like MATLAB and the availability of instrumentation like B&K instruments for in-ear calibration and measurement, better acoustical spaces, less expensive audio gear, the increasing compute power that can be directed towards things like ambisonics and wave field synthesis and other exotic means of either capturing or rendering 3D audio.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking for example, EOSono, which used wave field synthesis with a large linear array of speakers all the way around the theater.
Yes. Yeah. I actually had the privilege of visiting their labs, and I did hear the installation at the Man Chinese Theater. And I have to say, wave field synthesis is a great technique, and it's very, very interesting, but it's also quite quite equipment intensive. And in the 40 channel implementation that I heard in the Man Chinese Theater, very, very good performance, but I think the primary drawback is very expensive to deploy, and also it takes a lot of processing power in order to render in real time. Of course, with Moore's law, you can just wait a little while, and there'll be better processing, double processing power in 12 to 18
next
months.
Year.
But
yeah, right.
Yeah. But Wavefield, to do a really, really great sound, does require an awful lot of a high density of speakers, and that can render very, very high quality and, in fact, near field imaging, but at the cost of a lot of gear. So, you know, working in the practical world, we have to always take into consideration, what's the efficacy of a new technology given expensive deployment and limited resources that most consumers will have.
Right. A couple people are asking about frequency ranges and how high frequencies are more directional than low frequencies. And does that affect things?
Yes, that is something we think about all the time, and that we've worked to improve. Low frequencies tend to not be perceived as highly directional. That said, if you place in a large room, if you place a subwoofer close by, and if you place it off in a corner, you'll hear significant differences both in terms of frequency response as well as arrival time and overall auditory image. But most spatial imaging information is perceived in the higher frequencies, say above 100 cycles, and particularly in the speech ranges, we hear a lot of locational cues. So 500 to 5,000, especially the key frequencies around 2K, 2.5K, where speech formants and sibilants take place, we get a lot of spatial information from there. And it's interesting. Evolutionarily speaking, we needed it to survive. At the same time, we haven't done a very good job of leveraging that unique ability that we have as humans to be able to build a pretty accurate mental picture of our surroundings based simply on localization ability. Mm-hmm.
For example, SSB 201 is saying the lower the frequency, the less control you have to beam it in a given room. I'm not sure that's true.
To
some degree, probably, but I mean, you can have low frequency cancellation and destructive and constructive interference, right?
Yes, yes. And in fact, going back to the example of large system PA speakers and so forth, a known technique in, say, large auditoria is to do beamforming with subwoofers. And you can do beamforming with subwoofers by putting a bunch of subwoofers in line and spacing them carefully and controlling the delay between each subwoofer. And that will give you a much more confined, more unidirectional rather than omnidirectional diffusion pattern. So, in fact, that is used in difficult sound field control situations, especially in large arenas. So, yes, you can control low frequencies, and you can cancel low frequencies in general more easily than high frequencies, especially when they're periodic waveforms. So that's not always true. However, in an array, there is a lower limit and an upper limit to how accurately we can control our frequencies. So especially with these small drivers that we use, we start to lose control under around 200K. And so we have to use
200 hertz, you mean?
That's 200 hertz. And so we have to use differing techniques, including equalization or additional drivers in order to reproduce some of the lower frequencies. There's also something interestingly called spatial aliasing, which is where these foldovers and reflections take place. And that's always a factor of the spacing of speakers and particular frequencies being reproduced at speaker spacing intervals. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
It really is. I can't find it right now, but I did see a comment or a question earlier in the chat room referring back to that diagram of the head and the more beam-formed, less crosstalk between the ears. Doesn't that imply a very narrow sweet spot? That if you move out of that, there's the picture again, if you move out of that narrow sweet spot, the effect will be lost or compromised.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and it's true up to a point. So, yes, if I moved completely into the left channel beam, I would start to lose my full imaging, absolutely true. However, there are some things that we can do about that, and because of the fact that our beamforming is done with a real-time signal processor, we can move the beam as you move. Well, how do we move the beam? Well, we could tell the beam that we're moving. So, for example, if I had a smartphone and I had a little control and I say I want to move the beam over 6 inches to the left or maybe 12 inches to the left, I get about plus or minus 6 inches on just head movement without collapsing the binaural beam. But if I want to really move around a lot, then I would either tell the beam where I'm going or I would track my movement. And I can track my movement very easily using a video camera or something like a Kinect. And all we have to do is look about 10 times a second and track the profile. So if my profile moves a foot to the left, I can, as I'm moving, I can actually move the beam to follow me. If I've got a kind of static listening setup, let's say I'm doing 3D audio with games, and my son and I like to sit in our particular places and do our gaming stuff. Then we can set the beam so that they'll focus on the seating position where we are, and we'll stay in the sweet spot all the time.
Does that mean that you can actually beamform a stereo signal to two different locations at once?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, we did that at the Mass Effect ride in Santa Clara at Santa Clara's Great America theme park. We were approached by Electronic Arts and 3D Live, this great 3D visualization company, and they had a 60-foot wide 3D screen with just amazing 3D imagery. But unlike a traditional theater, this does not use a projection system or a PERF screen, and the imaging is has so much Z-plane, so much depth that images are actually floating over the audience. And the creators came to the lab and said, "We don't know what to do about this. We got this this money scene where a vehicle crashes and all these bugs come out and they fly around your head, and we don't know how to do that. We don't know of any surround sound system that can." That can reproduce that effect. And there's a particular point where we want to have a whisper right in the ear of the listener. How do you do that? So what we did was we used binaural encoding to put those near field sounds into the ears of the listeners, and we built them into the railings of the seating. And so we use one beamformer to cover two listeners, so one in front of two seats, and we are actually doing four beams, two pairs of binaural streams that are imaging very, very accurately. And this has been very well reviewed, and it's really exciting, an incredible, fun project to work on. And so, yeah, you can do, you can cover numerous people. We've also done some things like three beams, each beam doing a different language for signage or conferencing. And the amount of rejection that you get from one beam to the next, especially in a fairly well-controlled acoustical environment, is pretty impressive. We've done actual real live conferencing at the university where we had several talkers working in different languages, and we arranged the seating. So left third of the audience is German, center is English, and right side is Japanese, and the whole thing just went as smoothly as could be.
That's amazing. That's amazing. What about overhead sounds? We only have a few minutes left, but I really want to make sure we touch on that subject as well, because as we mentioned earlier, we now have immersive audio, Dolby Atmos, DTS:X, sure. Auro 3D. And so... Well, first of all, before we get to as part of that, let me show people the graphic, which I believe is called Effects. It's the next graphic in the queue there. And and this shows what might happen. And it addresses Hamid's question earlier about surround sound. And I would love for you to talk about this graphic and also talk about sounds from overhead, because this one looks like it's more or less a reproducing a traditional surround type format.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And so if we can zoom back just a little bit to see the kind of full effect there. So there's a couple of ways of producing binaural audio, which then is transformed into transaural audio and communicated over these speakers. And we can do that either by using a binaural head for recording, and this is very often done in game sound and in sound for VR and AR, or we can also synthesize that using an HRTF function, and Comhear has some very slick software for synthesizing this. Games do that in real time, and they do that using something called an HRTF, head-related transfer function, and we can put a sound effect so that it very easily images in the front 180, and in some cases very well even in the back 180, and we do that by carefully controlling arrival time between the left ear and the right ear, and some spectral shifts that are characteristic of particular placement of sound in space. And so this will allow us with just a small speaker bar to give very good traditional surround sound that renders well in the lateral plane. However, if we're careful and we capture elevated sounds, we can also position those sounds overhead or at a pretty acute elevation compared to, say, left front and right front at zero elevation. We can do lower elevations, say, down to minus 30, minus 40 degrees. And if we encode those sounds into our stereo signal, those will render pretty accurately on this system. So, in fact, we can have a kind of virtual Dolby Atmos overhead speaker. As I've commented before, home theater seems like it's almost a losing battle because it's very hard and expensive, and it takes a lot of work to add more and more channels to our home theater systems. And first it was 5.1, then 6.1, then 7.1, then 9.1. Now we're up to 11.2. requiring overhead speakers. So some kind of virtualization is really called for. And we think we've got a really good answer for that, in that we can do quite good imaging through binaural placement. We also could use beamforming to reflect an overhead signal off of the ceiling and onto the listener. And we do get accurate enough overhead beamforming placement to achieve that, but it does take some more equipment. You don't get it for free. So I think that binaural imaging tends to be the better answer, and it certainly is much less equipment intensive because you basically do it in software and encode that signal into what is essentially a regular stereo PCM or even AAC or any kind of encoded normal PCM like 16-bit or a higher signal.
I wanted to make sure everybody understood that when you mentioned specifically binaural recording, you're talking about having a dummy head with very accurately formed ears, right? The pinna, the outside of the ear and the ear canal. Put little microphones inside those ears, stick that head out in the audience, and any sound that comes at it from any direction is automatically encoded as having come from that direction because of the way the head is formed and the ears and so on. Right. Normally, you would play that back on headphones in order to eliminate crosstalk. But in this case, with the beamforming, you should be able to reproduce it with a beamforming line array. Or, as you say, you can take a sort of normal stereo recording and encode it with this binaural kind of information and get the same result. Quickly, I wanted to just mention that one of the folks in the chat room is Darren Fong of Out of Your Head fame. And he points out that headphones are not natural unless you're using Out of Your Head. Now, it's not the only one. There are several virtualization systems. We were talking about headphones earlier. I wanted to touch on this again. Several virtualization systems, including Out of Your Head, including Smith Realizer, including DTS Headphone X, that sort of make it seem like there are speakers out in front of you. And I just love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think there is good technology and good research that is that's yielding better performance in headphone listening and better externalization. And I think you gave us three very good examples. I know two of them, and I've heard steady progress in the two that I'm familiar with. I'm not saying this is an impossible problem to solve. On the other hand, I like the idea that that there are some alternatives to headphone-based or head-mounted display in the growing world of AR and VR. Honestly, I think there is plenty of room and that humans will always want to share exciting cultural and entertainment experiences. A fun Friday night for a couple of folks who are dating or sharing their evening together might just as easily involve going to a shared immersive experience and hearing very, very well rendered transaural 3D audio, which you can sort of enjoy together rather than spending the evening with head mounted displays and sort of having this uh,
this kind of isolated experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The sealed, isolated experience. I think, the new wave of entertainment, for example, the Mass Effect ride that I mentioned in Santa Clara at Great America, is a great example of a fun shared experience where everybody's really having the same experience. But on the other hand, we're all hearing that whisper right in our ear, and so I think there's more than one play in AR and VR and immersive sound. Obviously, MDA and Dolby Atmos are very good evidence that we want to move towards a really immersive sound. How do we get into the home? And how can we use these breakthroughs in music reproduction?
That was my last question for the day: is what can we expect into the home?
Yes. So one of the things that turns out to be infinitely amazing to me is how good just stereo music sounds on a good transaural system. So it turns out that as I mentioned before, a well-recorded stereo signal is full of very vivid spatial information. And that renders very well on the Comhear speaker and on speakers where crosstalk is well controlled. So what I think we're going to see is we're going to see a Comhear product that will play very nicely with gaming. So something that's optimized and is not too expensive for, you know, avid gamers to purchase. We're going to see something that is combining a very good sounding music system with a video and kind of home theater entertainment system that I think is going to be a really fun and, again, affordable immersive audio experience that is going to blend nicely in the living room or the family room. You're not going to have the issues of cabling and power and cutting holes in the speaker and pulling cable and all that kind of stuff.
So I can certainly see this applied to a sound bar, for example.
It has
been in the past. A Yamaha did something like this quite a few years ago. You're just taking it another level.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, that was my first experience with beamforming, and they did a great job. It was, this goes back about 10 years, I think.
And
what they were using reflective sound and sort of a monaural beam, so they weren't doing transaural. They were taking another approach, and it's absolutely creditable. And I love what they did with it. But I think this is the next step. It's a newer generation of all the components, and it also leverages mathematical modeling and so forth. So yes, there's going to be home sound bars. There's licensing discussions in place now. So I think we're going to see several products this year, and we can see it going into communications products as well as pro audio, as well as form factors that are made for home gaming and family room kinds of entertainment and higher end living room or higher end more audiophile, very high quality, again affordable music systems. And in fact, there is a website that's just gone up called yara3dx.com. Where interested listeners can hop on and join a mailing list to stay abreast of these developments.
But, and that's YARRA, numeral 3DX. Yes. Yara is the sort of consumer or brand that Comhear is establishing and working on?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So Yara.
Yara3dx.com. Yara, you'll notice, is, yeah, very good. Oh, great. You'll notice Yara is array spelled backwards.
Not sure I didn't notice that. That's great. I love it. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, listen, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and it's been such a great discussion, and I really appreciate you being here, and look forward to having you back on when we've got some actual products to talk about.
Okay. Yeah. These are coming into the pipeline. They'll be available shortly. So, Scott, it's been great. Your questions are great. Very perceptive. Very brainy stuff. So,
well, we like to geek out on this show. So,
okay.
Thank you so much. That's Peter Otto at ComHear. You can go to comhear.com. That's ComHear. Or now, Yara3DX.com, YARRA3DX.com. Peter, thanks again for being here.
Okay, take care.
You can find me always at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Philip Jones, who is the product technology manager at Sony, to talk about many of Sony's latest technologies, in particular video technologies. They came out with an awful lot of great stuff at CES, and so we're going to dig deep into those next week. However, I should point out that we're actually pre-recording that show tomorrow, Friday, February 10th at 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Pacific time, 8:30 to 9:30 Eastern time, so that it can be played at its normal time next Thursday when I'll be on vacation. So if you can, please join us live tomorrow, February 10th, Friday at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time. And hopefully we'll see you there in the chat room. Until then, geek out.